This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week we are going to complete the third of our trilogy. We had three different excellent conversations with some of the talent that was featured in this year's 50th and final Winter Carnival of Magic in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. This week we're going to be talking with David DaVinci, who is known as a thrillusionist, and he is an amazing illusionist, and he works not only with his dancers and these big illusions, but also with doves and parrots. And he has a great charisma on stage and talking with people. And it was so much fun to work with him. I was the master of ceremonies for that particular show and got to talk with him quite a bit backstage and to see him from the wings, no pun intended, regarding his doves and parrots. But it was a great show and standing ovation. It was well deserved. He received right after the show. But this gentleman has traveled about with the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus and worked for a while Zing Zang Zoom. All this is going to be discussed. I'm not going to tell you too much about his CV because, again, we talk about that during the show here and particularly whenever I introduce him. But again, he is called a thrillusionist because I think he really enjoys the thrill of danger. And I say that because he has worked with big cats to elephants, and he also skydives. He enjoys the great outdoors, and he is just an amazing gentleman and has a lot to share with us here this week. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. David DaVinci, here on The Magic Word. Today, my guest is someone who is an illusionist, and I love speaking with illusionists because it's so rare that I really get to talk with someone who does the big stuff. A lot of the people I have talked with in the past, as you well know, who are regular listeners, are people who are close-up, or they're collectors, or mentalists, or working with bizarre stuff, or other kinds of things. But someone who is an illusionist, it seems like, is almost a dying breed today. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, and the fact that he works with a lot of doves. Birds of all kind. We'll talk about that. And I've had several people on, or as many people as I know, like Jason Byrne and James DeMayer and a few others who are bird guys in the past that I've had over here. So want to kind of, I'm not completing it, but I'm adding to this mix someone who has been on my radar for a while. I've been wanting to talk with, and I'm sure you will enjoy learning from. If you're thinking about going down this path as well, please welcome my friend, David DaVinci. Hey there, David. How are you?
Thanks for having me. That's quite the intro.
I'm so glad to get the chance to chat with you about this, because I was a dove magician and had worked with livestock. Well, mine was a rabbit, a man-eating rabbit. In fact, it took a chunk out of my finger one time, and that's when I got rid of the rabbit.
but you didn't get tigers.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But I did work with doves and all that and raised them, but I didn't spend the time that a lot of people do, like Amos Lefkovich did with, you know, they were like family to him. And I'm sure, like with you, your doves and your toucans, or what kind of birds do you use? A macaw and everything, I guess, is all part of the family.
Yeah, it's all part of the family. We have 10 parrots and 14 doves, and wow, we actually just got a dog. So, and it's a bird dog. So I do a little bit of bird hunting as well. And so she's a Vizsla, and we could go down a long rabbit hole of why I decided to get this dog. It's actually a pretty cool story if we want to circle back to it. But yeah, the animals are definitely part of our family. In fact, one of the reasons I think it is a dying breed is, as illusionists as well as bird guys, is because just traveling with them is so difficult now.
Sure.
You know, I drove 4 days to get here to this convention.
Because you're in Oregon or Washington?
In northern Idaho.
Idaho, okay.
Yep. I used to live in Spokane, Washington.
That's what I grew up.
So that's probably why that was on your radar. Right. But yeah, so northern Idaho, I'm an hour from Canada, and it was a four-day drive to get here. And, you know, we're staying the night in 15-degree Fahrenheit temperatures. So I'm running a generator and I'm checking the baby monitor, and then the generator runs out of gas. And so I got to run back out, fill it in 15 degrees with, you know,
oh my gosh,
just to keep my birds alive and happy and healthy. So, you know, unfortunately, they come to the cost of, like, you lose sleep on these trips. And
right.
And then by the time you get to the venue, you're running off adrenaline, which can only last for so long. But yeah, when you have animals, they are your family, and you do need to take care of them. And And most hotels don't let us bring in 10 parrots and 14 doves and a dog. So we have custom trailers and stuff for that exact purpose.
Well, just bringing in doves. I remember working in a hotel once. I was in Kansas City with my doves. And whenever I checked in, the bellboy had brought in all my stuff, including my doves. And I got a call from the lobby, you know, from the manager downstairs and saying, sir, I understand that you got birds in your room. And I said, yes, I do. And I said, well, it's against our policy. You can't keep them in the room. I said, I understand. I'll get rid of it, no problem. And I thought it was the guy who had hired me who was joking with me and who had called me and was kind of jacking with me and saying, hey, this, you know, because we had, it was really pretty cool because they had flown me in their private jet to Kansas City to do the show.
Oh, that's cool.
And we had the birds, my wife and I had the birds in the cage in there. And the guys who were the pilots saying, can we keep the birds up front? We kind of want to watch and see how birds react when they're in the atmosphere. And anyhow,
that's wild.
It was pretty wild. But anyhow, so we got to know this guy pretty well who had hired us. And so once I got, as I said, I thought it was a joke. And so I just left them in the bathtub, didn't say anything, you know, the cage in there. But
I had 2 years ago, I was filming a project with First Form, which is a fitness and supplement company that sponsors me for wingsuiting. And so for 9 mornings in a row, we were going up to 10 to 12,000 feet above ground in a hot air balloon with a falcon. And I'd jump from the balloon in a wingsuit and fly with this peregrine falcon.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing, you know, it's like we're in the hotel and it's like, how do you explain that you've got this peregrine falcon that's eating like and flinging guts all over the room? Fortunately, they're quiet, right?
But I assume just kept it in the bathroom.
It was a single bed room and he had kind of where a second queen bed would be. He had just a big tarp down. And then the falcons have basically like a little station that they stay on when they're kept in this type of environment. And he's a he's a professional falconer and he hunts with them and everything. And so, so she just stayed like right on this little perch and loose, you know, not flying around the room, thankfully.
But. Yeah. Well, for those who are listening, by the way, I'm not going to gloss over something that he just said as far as the wingsuiting and parachuting and things like that. We're going to circle back and I want to talk a little bit about that as well, which I think is pretty fascinating as well as something that you do. But turning on then with the birds, another thing I was thinking, I really hadn't thought so much about traveling across the country with animals like that because of, number one, you can't bring them into the where you're staying.
Yeah.
And number two, then with the weather being as it is, you have to go out and worry about them all the time, make sure that they're going to be comfortable then. It's like having a dog outside, I guess, when the temperatures are below freezing, they always say, bring your pets inside or whatever, but you can't, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing I was thinking about was about just for cruising, whenever that you have to quarantine your animals. Mm-hmm. Are there some countries that don't have the quarantine rules or how does that work?
Only if they know that you brought them in. There may have been one of those in my past.
That's right.
It pays wink, me wink, not a magician there. No, I admit to it. I just won't tell anybody what country, but I definitely smuggled them through. But there's, depending on the country and all of that, there's different quarantine. And there's basically USDA and U.S. Fish and Wildlife in domestically, and they don't really get along per se. And so you need certain permits for parrots and import and export permits, even if it's poultry. And it's just a whole big mess. And that's why guys don't do it. So I actually I assembled my Dove Act in a way that I could show up in Kyrgyzstan with, and they would give me 8 wild doves, and by know, 3 hours later, they'd be in the act.
Really?
And it's not a pat on my own.
You can train them like that.
Well, that's what I was about to say. It's not a pat on my own back. It's just the way the act was designed to be able to travel without having to have my own doves that are like my better doves.
Yes.
And I'm able to work with them just, and that was a case that happened. We flew to Kyrgyzstan, and here's your doves. And I'm like, these things have like, did you just catch them? They were so wild. But that's part of the challenge of when you are touring as a professional bird act. You got to figure out where and how to get birds if you
right.
can't bring your own.
Right. Well, if you're touring with big cats, that's a whole other situation then. Did you ever work with big cats?
Man, I've been so fortunate in my career. I've worked with tigers. I've worked with leopards. I've worked with lions. I've worked with elephants. And out of 10,000 shows, I've probably done between 2,500 and 3,000 with big animals. Mm-hmm. And it's just been amazing. In fact, we recently got to go meet back up. There's 2 out of the 3 elephants we worked with are still alive. And one is the oldest or second oldest in captivity. And she remembered me. And it was so cool.
Wow.
After every show, I'd go up to her and she'd put her head down and I'd go give her a big hug around her trunk. And she'd always make this really distinct sound only with me.
Huh.
And with elephants, it's protected contact primarily now. So they're behind these like big steel bars that they can't plow through and injure people.
Mm-hmm.
And so Susie, they just took down the fence, let us go back in there. And I was like, man, it was the coolest thing in the world. She comes over, puts her head down, just and just like, oh, it was so cool. And my daughter got to see, because she wasn't born at the time that we had,
right,
you know, this, the 2-year tour with the elephants and everything. And anyway, it's been, man, what a blessing to be at the tail end of that part of magic, right?
Are they in Florida, I'm assuming?
Oklahoma, actually.
Oklahoma, is that right? Okay, I know. I was going to say that's the other state I know where there are some elephants like that. But because you had worked with Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey for a long number of years, I guess,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we did. We were fortunate enough to be able to headline a 2-year tour with them. Mm-hmm. It had like 5 different show names, so I got to headline 5 different Ringling shows. Mm-hmm. But no, it's just one tour for 2 years, and it was amazing experience. Learned a lot, and honestly, it's where I found my persona and character and like really honed it. Hmm. A lot of guys talk about that. And I talked about it on the Magic Master Summit, you know, and I did interviews with Michael Trix and Dan Sperry, and all these guys have these really honed, amazing characters that that may not be like, I remember when Dan Sperry kind of went his whole like gothic route, and it was like, how is he going to make it? And I was so stoked to see him this convention, and like, what an amazing act. And he is like, you know, he's taken his branding to a whole different level. And it was cool talking to him about it, because he branded himself at kid shows and birthday parties with this character. And so Ringling really helped me kind of find who that is for me and what my character is. And because I didn't know for a long time, and that 2 years kind of helped me hone what I wanted it to be. And yeah, it's a lot of shows.
And realize how that you can actually make that compact enough to take on the road as well. Because you'll learn, I'm sure, like how to tour with the circus. They're doing a lot of that for you. But when you're on your own, that's a whole different matter.
Yeah. On tour with this particular circus, they had 3 units. The red and the blue traveled by train. The gold unit traveled by truck and trailer. And so my wife and I each drove a truck. We each had a trailer. She had our RV. I had a 24-foot cargo trailer with the birds and the props and a motorcycle. Because once we got someplace, I wanted to be able to get around. So. Sure. So we had the motorcycle in there, and it was still, we were setting up and tearing our own stuff down. It was hard work, but it was really good. And so, you know, good in the sense of like to work that hard and really earn it, you know, pay your dues. And I think that's missing from a lot of guys that don't get to do that, you know, not everybody's cup of tea, but yeah, it taught us a lot about how to travel, what kind of stuff. What do we have to do to our props to make them take that abuse? Because when you're on the road, you can't like send the prop back to a builder and say, hey, fix this. Mm-hmm. You got to do it yourself. And so we learned quickly what sort of things we had to do on future props to make sure they could withstand.
Were you on the tail end then basically of the circus life? I mean, from the standpoint, once they got rid of the elephants and then eventually the circus kind of all folded. And there's really no place like that for someone to jump in and get the kind of experience that you have. It's hard to find.
It is hard to find. We actually been really fortunate to play a Shriners circus every 2 to 3 years in Evansville, Indiana at the Ford Center. Mm-hmm. And that was the last year that they had the elephants. And we showed up and they had, I think, 10 or 11 elephants. It was a lot. Mm-hmm. And it was like, that was it. That wasn't ever happening again. And we show up and they're like, hey, Jamie, to my wife. And they're like, you used to ride elephants. You want to be in the act? And like, if you've ever been at a circus, like, that's kind of how it goes. Like, yeah, hop on, right? Sure.
Everybody helps each other.
Yeah, and she used to do headstands and handstands on the elephant act and on our tour. And so she's like, sure, which one? They're like, that one. So she hops on. And the elephant world's kind of funny because of PETA and all of this.
Right.
The trainers don't really tell you all the animals' names or ages because they want to confuse the mass public as much as possible, in my viewpoint, so that there's no straight story that comes back of like, oh, so-and-so did this or so-and-so did that, because quite honestly, if you mishandle an elephant, they'll kill you. It's that simple.
I've heard that.
Not that it hasn't happened in the past, but I think it has such a bad rep, unfortunately. But off my high horse there, we get to backstage, and so there she's like, well, what's the choreography going to be? And they just, oh, just follow the person in front of you. Mm-hmm. She was the front person. And she leans into this elephant, and she's like, I know you. And it was Bonnie or Bunny. She had 2 different names. And of course, the trainer's like, nope, that's not her. That's not her. And it was the one elephant on our tour 12 years ago that nobody wanted to ride because she's too young and spunky. Well, this was her last show before retirement. So she got to kind of be reunited. My daughter got to meet that elephant as well.
Pretty cool.
And then we saw her. She went from that show. This is only a couple, 2-3 years ago. She went from that to the Sanctuary, which we ended up seeing her. And then Susie was the one that's the older one. So yeah, crazy animals.
Well, speaking of elephants, I had heard a story many years ago from someone who was saying in a circus, there was an animal trainer or elephant trainer who had a new guy he had just hired, and the guy was in cleaning the cage. And when the elephant started moving towards this guy, he was backing off. And the more he'd back off, the more the elephant kind of pushed towards him. And the fellow who had hired him fired him that day on the spot. He said, you can never go back and work in there because the elephant knows he has control of you.
Interesting.
And, you know, you need to take charge and stand your ground against the elephant, even though they're bigger than you, to kind of let them know who's boss, but you're out of here.
Interesting. We traveled with our house cat for that whole 2 years. And so every I don't know how she'd know we were getting close to the arena, but she'd travel in the truck and she would just get annoying right before we'd get there. And so we let her out as we set up the RV, and then she'd roam around the whole place, and then she'd find our RV and come back. And
yeah,
there's only two times out of that 2 years we couldn't find her. And if we couldn't find her, she was always by the elephants hanging out. And it was like, it was the coolest thing. We have this one picture of her just sitting. It was like she found company in the elephants, and the elephants were gentle around her. You know, they didn't have any ill will or anything, but it was wild. It was,
wow.
I have so many stories from just our adventures on the road, and it's crazy to get to do what we do.
Like what? Give me a couple of it, kind of come off the top of your mind.
Oh, well, okay. Let's stick back to the elephant. So one of the trainers, he would work in a Mexican circus at some point in his past life. And
boy, that's a different kind of circus.
Oh, it's a little more rugged.
Yeah.
And so he was used to kind of, you know, doing his own thing and the way he wanted to do it. Well, he drove this beat up old Freightliner, as you can imagine. Right. And the elephants don't say like, hey, elephants inside the semi. It's very discreet.
Mm-hmm.
Also, this other semi's stuck in the off the side of the road, and he's dug into the mud pretty bad. And so this guy, the trainer, comes out. He's like, hey, you need help? And the guy laughs at him. He's like, what are you gonna do, pull me out with that thing? He's like, I'll bet you, I'll get you out. So he bets him. So he takes the elephants out, hooks them up, and they pull the semi out. Like, you imagine driving down I-90 or something. You see these elephants pulling a semi.
Wow.
And the elephants are like, you know, I don't want to anthropomorphize, but they appear to be happy to do it. They definitely, in the animal training world, which is a whole other part of my profession, is we don't want to project human emotions on them because we'll potentially misread it. And long story short, we're not usually accurate.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's a lot of evidence that shows animals have a desire to work. And so when we have them in captivity, one of the best things we can do is train them and quote unquote, put them to work, maybe not pulling semis out of a ditch.
Yeah.
But in this case, they seem to be happy to do it. But, you know, teaching a bird to put a coin in a piggy bank is one of the best mental stimulation you could do for a pet parrot, where otherwise they go nuts and they'll pull their feathers because they're bored.
Need something to do.
They're flock species. And if they're sitting alone in a cage and we give them a 24-hour buffet of food and water, we're actually not doing them a service. We're doing them a huge disservice.
Because
in the wild, they would spend half their day flying around, expending physical energy.
Foraging for food.
And then, exactly. And then foraging, looking for food, expending mental energy. But in captivity, we just stick them in a cage. And we're like, hey, here's free access. And it's like, you know, it's a challenging spot because there's a stigma of like, oh, I don't want to have a trained monkey or training is bad or whatever, but it gives them something to focus on. And we see a huge improvement in the quality of their life when we do that.
Sometimes you can baby an animal too much. My wife had an aunt with a little poodle that she carried around all the time and would feed it chicken without the bones. She pulled the bones out and everything.
Jeez.
So that way that it wasn't using its teeth, you know, to chew on a bone or whatever. Long story short, the dog lost its teeth.
Yeah.
And basically had to start gumming the food because she was pampering it too much.
Yeah.
There's a diet you're supposed to be treating animals. And a lot of people don't understand what the diet should be.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's, I could spend hours talking about that with parrots, but I would probably bore 95%.
Are there different kinds of feeding regimens for different kinds of parrots?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There's kind of a more or less standard that we would do for a captive parrot, as we call it. So if a bird, if a parrot's going to be in its cage most of its life and it doesn't free fly, then we'll feed it a certain type of diet. But if it's actively outdoors free flying, meaning we fly it outside and it comes back, then we need to have a little higher calorie content in their diet.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Because they're athletes at that point.
Yeah.
In fact, a gentleman, his name's Tony, he came out here to where we pigeon forge from Flint, Michigan. And we just over Thanksgiving or not Thanksgiving, what was it? Anyway, just a couple weeks ago, we were over in near Vegas, a place called Amargosa Valley. And his bird in the 1 week, we have little GPS units we put on it, and he has a macaw. In 1 week, this bird did over 100 miles of flying. So the standard diet would never work for that bird.
Right.
So we have to adjust things based on that, but there's species specific requirements too.
And with your why or how did you determine the ones you wanted to use?
As far as a performance?
Yes,
or
performance,
an average
flight? Yeah.
For performance, it's actually really interesting. So each parrot has their own things that they're naturally good at. And so we built the routines around them.
Oh.
So Bondi, my Gla, is really good at retrieve. And so one of the routines I'm the most proud of is my ring and gumball routine.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wanted to do this trick, but I never was that original of a rider. And then I started riding with like, what if the bird's the one screwing everything up and she flies off stage with the ring and loses it?
Hmm.
And you'll see it tonight. But because she's good at retrieve, I built this routine around her. And in theory, she should live 40, 50 years old. She's almost 20 right now,
mm-hmm.
and still seems to thrive and enjoy doing the show. Mm-hmm. Jinx is one of our macaws, and he's really good at return flights where he flies out, does a nice tight circle, comes back. He is one of the most reliable birds. So if we're doing TV work or there's a boom camera and he appears, right? Like he didn't get the chance to see the room first. He has no idea. He appears. He quickly navigates through all that stuff and comes back and lands on me 100% of the time. He's just been fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So we built him into the routine based on that. So we have a lot of parrots for our other business, Bird Tricks, and where we teach people to train their pet parrots. And our mission over there is saving parrots one person at a time. Mm-hmm. And that's through education. And so we've got a lot of parrots for that we've also integrated into Magic for tax write-offs. So,
wow. Wow. Fascinating. On circuses, by the way, did you ever work with Zing Zang Zoom as well?
Yeah. So the original Zing Zang Zoom, I believe, was the blue unit, which traveled by train.
Okay.
So we ended up renaming. At one point, they were messing with branding, and we were Zing Zang Zoom for, I think, the second year of the tour.
Was that the year that Alex Ramone was the ringmaster or zingmaster with you?
So that was his run. I ended up doing it afterwards,
okay.
and they took that name eventually into the smaller unit and made a small Zing Zang Zoom. So I never worked with him personally, but mm-hmm. same show title, but I was a magician in the second version.
Okay. Yeah. And is there any iteration of the circus at all still today? I mean, as far as like touring in coliseums?
Yeah, there's lots of circuses still. They're smaller, but the animal stuff's pretty much
gone. Mm-hmm.
There's
just acrobats, basically.
Paranormal Cirque is like, it's an adult circus.
What's paranormal?
Paranormal Cirque.
Okay, is that Brooke Vegas, I guess, or where?
It travels in a tent.
Okay.
And it's like, I think they should hire Sperry. I mean, it's a Halloween show all year round, and it's really clever. And everything, you can tell the producers took like a sword swallower, for example, and they put her in a really sexy outfit. And then they, you know, instead of the swords being presented nicely on like a display table, they're like coming out of a body and have like a mannequin that's been impaled. So
okay.
they took everything kind of like gorded up for a Halloween theme. But but that show was a hoot. That was really fun. And yeah, so there's different types of circuses still touring. Ringling is back. They just don't have animals anymore, but they're touring still.
Yeah.
And they have one of the like robot dogs from, I think, Boston Dynamics, the ones that like I think the military's using them with like machine guns on them. I don't think Ringling has the machine gun version, but the same dog.
I'm not familiar with the robot dogs.
Oh, they're incredible. Yeah, they look up, I believe it's Boston Mechanics, and it's like a robot dog, and they're uh-huh. crazy. But that's the only animal they have in the show is this robotic futuristic
companion. Do you stick to the U.S. mostly now, or do you still do some cruises or work outside or Canada, Mexico? Or
I get to travel all over. I work Canada a lot. I don't do cruises anymore. My daughter's 11 and
we'll stay closer to home.
Yeah. I'm really fortunate that I'm at a spot in my life and my career where my bird training business funds me. Mm-hmm. And so I take the magic shows I want to do. I'm still doing 50 to 100 shows a year. So I'm staying current, but instead of 500 or 600 shows a year. So I like this pace a little better.
Yeah.
But I get to fill in for Greg Fruin frequently up in Niagara Falls,
mm-hmm.
which is really cool. And I was thinking about it here. You know, I don't do a lot of magic conventions. And early on, they gauge you on originality and all of that. And and I was just thinking about what a cool kind of full circle this is for me, because Greg Fruin's been a mentor of mine for years. And it's you see it in my act, right? For sure. And one of the benefits is every time he'd create something, I'd beg him and let me, like, eventually he'd sell me one. So I'm like one of the only guys that has one of just about everything he does or makes.
Mm-hmm.
So when he needed me to fill in or needed somebody to fill in, I'm like, man, I've done these illusions for 12, 13, 15 years.
I can slide in easy.
I can, if a roller shade breaks, I can fix it. And so,
yeah.
or whatever, I know how to work the insides and outsides of these props. So the show, I can transition up there pretty seamlessly. And in turn, I'm super grateful to be the only guy in the world that's allowed to do his old ending from World's Greatest Magic of his Dove Act. So if you guys have seen it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't seen it, you'll soon know. But yeah, it's kind of humbling because I'm like, gosh, are people going to think I'm just a copycat? But at the same time, I think it's really worth mentioning how important mentors are.
That's true.
And in this especially in this day and age, everybody's afraid of being copied or copying other people. And yeah, I do a lot of the same stuff as Greg, but I do it with my twist or my way, or it's, yeah, it's his props or his designs, but I get to add my flair to it. And so I think that's really important. But also, he gifted me one of his acts, which you'll see tonight as well, that I do just verbatim. It's almost like, yeah, tribute's not quite the right word. The right word's not coming to me, but it's pretty cool to see that. And I'm in my early 40s now, and I just want to encourage people that are in their 40s or later to find people to mentor. And
you should. And Greg certainly is a good mentor. I know he had mentored Ding Yang,
yeah,
who is tremendous FISM winner, you know, yeah. Very phenomenal. Got her own unique twist on that as well.
Yeah.
And last I talked with Greg, he was going to close the theater. Sorry, he was changing the theater and turning it over to another gentleman, Christian.
Rishimasha?
That's it. Yep. Yes. Has that transition happened? And so, or is he still kind of in and out, or?
They tried it for a bit and have changed direction.
Okay.
So right now he's actually got I believe in his main show, it's him and Alexandra. Mm-hmm. And she's been on Fool Us.
She's amazing.
Oh, she's phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
And she started as an assistant for him, I think, when she was like 17.
They're not married.
Something. Nope.
Just assistant. Yeah.
Just assistant. Yeah. But she was super young when she started at the theater. And so it's really cool for her to like grow up being a dancer, but then kind of get to put on the top hat and have Greg's direction, you know, mm-hmm. to be able to help her. And obviously she's got her own ideas, and just to be in that position is pretty cool. So right now I believe what they're doing is a duo show.
Okay.
When I go up, I do my show, and it's neat too, because I've worked with Alexandra as a dancer in the show. I've also worked with Erica up there. Mm-hmm. And so I can show up and like, we might have a day of rehearsal or like an hour of rehearsal. But we've worked together for so many years. It's like, it's great to be able to just pick up where you left off, and you know, we know how to cover for each other, direct each other if somebody's off or whatever, because I'm doing half my show, half his show,
right?
And so she's doing half their show and she's doing half my show, so we're having to help each other in it. And you know, it kind of goes back to what I was saying about the doves. When you go overseas and you do the bird act, you have to structure your show in a way that you can borrow birds,
right?
And I'm finding that within the illusions, where certain illusions we design or work in, where it's like, yeah, I could train a dancer that before mm-hmm. the show, which again you'll see tonight. We have two local dancers, so yeah, it's all those things that you learn through, like you said earlier, trial by fire, and man, you got to make a lot of mistakes, but having a mentor really helps you out.
It seems that you would be a perfect fit then, if that didn't work out with Christian Macha, that for him to have you come in and take that over. Because I know he was saying, you know, I've got gray hair, I'm starting to, you know, transition out. I'm thinking, you know, I've got to have an exit strategy here. And if that other one didn't work out, it looks like that you'd be a good choice and to kind of move in there.
I love performing.
But not in one place.
And I'm really loving performing not full time.
Okay. I hear that.
Yeah. There should an opportunity come up in the future where I can do extended runs multiple times a year. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'd be in it in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. I love living in North Idaho, and living in Niagara Falls, Canada is quite the culture shock compared to North Idaho. And so that,
well, they're both cold, I would think.
No, they're both cold. Yeah. They're both cold. And you know, I'll just be blunt. I can't go out and shoot targets or bird hunt out in Niagara Falls, at least on the Canadian side. So, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of my hobbies are
outdoor activities.
Outdoor activities, we'll say that, yeah. So long term, it'd be tough for me to live in Canada for that reason. Having that be one of the many reasons. But I do love going up there and performing, and it's always, they treat me great. It feels like home, and yeah.
I want to talk about illusions also, but when you had opened the door there as far as outdoor activities and everything, we mentioned about the wingsuit and everything, and I always think of that as like a flying squirrel kind of a thing. Is that right, basically?
That's the best way to picture it.
Is that pretty scary the first time you kind of think, I'm just out here without a parachute, it's just wings?
Well, I'll add some context, but it's terrifying every time.
Okay.
Almost every time. In the moment where you aren't a little scared is where stuff goes wrong.
Uh-huh.
And so it's
good to have
really
that adrenaline rush.
Well, and it's, I've tried to figure out what skydivers have, like, what is it that we all have in common that mm-hmm. makes us do this? And I think that skydivers have a unique perspective or association with fear mm-hmm. and how we deal with it. And like being here at this show, being the closing act of the closing show of the closing night of a convention that's been excelling for 50 years, mm-hmm. I love that pressure, right? Like that's like, I get goosebumps thinking about it. I love that. Like it's humbling. It's intimidating as hell, but that's the kind of pressure and kind of the mindset I think that a lot of skydivers have is just the understanding of things can go wrong. They do often go wrong. And in what order do you take care of them? And what's the priority? And we're trained very well, very highly trained for it. It's actually a relatively safe sport. So, but then jumping back to the other part is, you know, I'm out here flying in a squirrel suit and I don't have a parachute. And I just want to add some clarification. There's all of our wingsuit skydives. I have two parachutes. So I'm wearing a backpack that has your main. And then there's a little computer in there that most people don't know about the size of a AAA battery. And it's called an AAD. It's an automatic activation device. What that means, let's say I'm flying with a buddy or two and we bump heads and I'm unconscious.
Okay.
If I'm at 1,000 feet and still at terminal velocity, my main is cut and my reserve will deploy automatically with that computer. And that saved a lot of people's lives.
It recognizes that something has happened? Or
it measures your free fall rate. And if you're not under parachute, it knows it.
I see.
Right. So if in a regular skydive, you're going down about 140 miles an hour. With a wingsuit, it's a little bit different. We go forward 140 miles an hour, but we were free falling about 40 miles per hour down. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of gliding at a bit of an angle. We're converting that, you know, downward speed for forward speed. And we can actually get lift and get back up in the air. It's really wild.
But it's like a glider.
Yeah. We're just meat missiles up there.
meat missiles.
And we can cover. So in Hawaii, I jump out on the North Shore a lot and we get up to about 18,000 feet above sea level. And you're on oxygen from 12.5 to 18. And then you open the door and we'll be 3.5 miles away from the drop zone. And we jump out and make a formation flight. I have this really cool picture of 9 of us wingsuiting, make this big formation flight. And we fly 3.5 miles back to the airport and then deploy our parachutes and land.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
We can cover a lot of land. And it's really fun to learn how to fly with other people. And our fall rates are all going to be different because of our body height and size and everything. Mm-hmm. So we have to configure our bodies in these suits to not fly past everybody, not fly above or below, but like get right into what we call our slot and fly next to somebody, or you flip to your back and you fly on your back underneath them. And it's really wild, but it's something where I don't do it to chase the adrenaline. The adrenaline goes away. Like it's still super fun, but the adrenaline is lost in the first 100 jumps.
You jumped how many times? 600?
About 650.
Yeah.
I'd have to look at my logbook. One of the balloon jumps that I just did was my last one. And I haven't jumped as much in the last year as I would like to. So, but yeah, it even at 650 jumps and 350 of those are in a wingsuit. And you want to be on your toes. You want to be a little bit afraid and just understand how to, you know, if your main parachute doesn't work right, what do you do?
Right.
And the answer is you cut away, but you know, there's some things to solve it before you try that.
So have you done any escapes from the air? I mean, because you've done some escapes.
Yeah. My first hot air balloon ride, I was drug underneath it in a straitjacket. Okay. and actually my first two hot air balloon rides were like that. And so
then you escaped and then dropped and then had a parachute deploy.
Well, I wish I could have done that. No, I would escape and then they lowered a ladder and I climbed up the ladder to get in the basket.
Oh, I see.
And then it came down. So I did that. I do a water tank escape. I haven't done it for a couple of years, but I do an underwater escape that Greg built me. All these are like, well, Greg built me this, Greg built me that. He's a phenomenal builder, by the way. Anybody looking for illusions, knows how to make them roadworthy.
Didn't know he was a builder too.
Phenomenal builder. Yeah. Shroud, Squisher, the Bird Act, all this stuff is built by him. And he just understands what it takes to live on the road and travel with these things and what the abuse is. And he builds them
to last and to work.
Yeah.
He may have told me that because we did an episode together some time ago and I talked to him about a variety of things that may have just kind of gone out of my mind that he was actually a builder then as well. But and being an adrenaline junkie, that's why I thought you probably have done a lot of escapes. I know in your bio that you have say you've done some escapes then too. So
yeah. And I used to free dive when we lived on Saipan. I would free dive every day and my personal best, I think, was 77 feet. And I could hold my breath for 3.5 minutes and I'd go out. That's how I'd eat and go down and I'd catch a fish and we'd cook it up and then go do two shows. And then that was our day every day.
Okay. And was there something, what I read, that an underwater card stab or something?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was just a card sword. It was a publicity stunt. You know, it was a card sword underwater. And then I built it into the show where I had a force where people could find the card. And then I'd go free dive and I speared the card and found it. And then returned to the surface. It was just visually, it was cool. It was different. And so, you know, with ringling, I really, my branding of Thrillusionist kind of came into play. And so I started thinking, well, how do I tie these things together? And so when we have venues that have video projection available, I do what's called a skydive card trick. So same idea, somebody picks a card freely. And it's a video of me from, gosh, 10 years ago almost. Mm-hmm. And I'm like talking through to my future self saying, hey, I knew that you'd be at this theater performing. Find the person in the front row. They're going to pick a card. And it walks me through the whole thing. And then the next shot is I'm in the plane with half the cards spread in each of my hands. Mm-hmm. And I jump. And as I'm free falling through the earth from 18,000 feet, I let go of the cards and they all hit my helmet. And there's like four or five on there. And then one kind of goes away, two goes away, three. And then there's one left mm-hmm. and it's their card, but it's actually inside the helmet.
Inside the helmet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we filmed that with two different versions.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm being cheated though, because now with AI, I could do it with all 52 and only have to do the jump once or not even actually do the jump.
Well, but that's true too.
Yeah. I do want to update it to a wingsuit jump, and the logistics of that are a little bit more difficult to go through that many cards at 140 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. Like I cut my neck doing the original filming.
With what,
a card hit my neck and yeah. sliced it. Yeah.
Huh.
You know, we're doing 140 miles an hour down.
Sure. You can imagine.
And now with a wingsuit, it's going to look a little bit different. But what we do is they call them unicorn mounts. And we put a GoPro 360 on the end.
Yep.
And then when you look, if you guys go on my Instagram, you see lots of this type of footage. It's just Thrillusionist. So illusionist with T-H-R at the front. But this unicorn mount in a GoPro 360 makes it look like Tinkerbell's out in front of you filming.
Hmm.
And so what I want to do, if we're able to refilm the skydive or wingsuit card trick, is have that be the sword. And so it actually spears.
Oh, no, that's a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's dangerous to have that out there because it's a snag hazard. So
yes.
I don't do a lot of jumps with a unicorn mount, as they say. But and the camera technology has gotten so good. You don't really need a 12-inch stick off the top of your head. You can get away with like a little 3-inch mount for a camera, which is
right.
much safer.
Right, right.
But yeah, wild stuff.
Wow, it is. I had just spoken, well, I had another episode I did with Jonathan Goodwin before his accident. And then I ran into him when he had lectured at Blackpool just recently as well. And one of the things I was talking to him about was how believable escapes are to an audience about how, and I say believable, whether they think the person is really in trouble, in jeopardy, you know, could be injured or lose their life or whatever.
Yeah.
And equally important, why would a person come on stage and, let's say, put their head in a guillotine?
Right.
You know, it's like, sure, whatever. You know,
right.
Do they really believe that there was going to be something? Why would you do that if you thought
right.
there was a potential of injury? So they know that all of this must be not magic, but fun of some sort. Do you think the audience believes that people are in trouble sometimes for these kinds of?
I don't. Now I will say the underwater escape that I do, it has a metamorphosis like surprise ending,
okay.
right?
That's
and,
good.
And so it's not about can he escape. We build the suspense and the drama and the tension where they're like, holy crap, I can't hold my breath that long.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're starting to get uncomfortable because they know that I got to be running out of air soon. And then I've already showed them. So I start my escape by showing how to pick a lock. So I have a clear padlock and picks, and I show them how to actually pick a lock.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have somebody tie me up. And so you see me picking the locks in the tank. So they see like, okay,
sure.
He's picking them, but then what?
Right.
And I think for me, my approach with it was to have a series of three within the entire act. So with the escapes, with the music, with all this stuff, and really building the suspense around, one, they have no idea what's going to happen other than I'm going to escape.
Mm-hmm.
But then to kind of kick him with the surprise of the switch at the end. It's not about right. like I get out of the cuffs and then I open up the box and I come
Ta-da.
Out.
Right.
Right. It's like I'm actually stuck in there allegedly. And I think that they believe to some degree, like, okay, he's stuck. Maybe his life's in danger. I will say this. My mother-in-law watched from the front row and she came up after the show and slugged me and she looks me square in the eyes and she says, I hate that trick. So it was believable enough to her.
Sure.
Yeah. But for people maybe that don't care about us, I don't know.
My wife always hated the spiker illusion, you know, that was the Andre Cole, you know, bed of nails
yeah.
Kind of a thing. It's just whenever that...
The table of death?
Table of death. This, whenever yeah. that clunk, you know, it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. I got injured on that a lot, actually.
Did you really?
On the final...
Because you're trying to roll out.
On the final move, yeah. It would bounce up at the same time I was doing the move. And I would,
thought about it.
I mean, I probably had permanent bone damage in my right arm from where it would hit.
Uh-huh.
But you'd be surprised. People don't realize how dangerous illusions and magic are. Like, you know, you look at skydiving and people think, oh, he's got a death wish or he's reckless. But man, myself, my family been more injured in the shows. I ended up in the hospital in Saipan because I was going down a mirror tunnel and slit my head open.
Hmm.
My wife fell off an illusion, shattered her wrist, and the cruise ship just dropped her off the coast of Africa to fend for herself. I still have some trauma around that, I think. And that actually almost was, what, 8 years ago to date.
What was it exactly?
She fell off of an illusion and shattered her wrist.
Okay.
And the cruise ship doctor took x-rays and says, oh, good news, it's just dislocated, but we're going to have to get a second opinion. It's like, dude, you don't go to school for 8 years to work in the basement of a cruise ship, right? And then not be able to tell if it's shattered or dislocated.
Yeah, it looked like potato chips.
They never did give us the x-rays. So anyway, we woke up to security escorting her off the ship that next morning because they didn't want to deal with her. Mm-hmm. I haven't been on Norwegian Cruise Line since. So
wow.
Yeah, not mm-hmm. real happy with that. The way they handled it was pretty terrible. And you know, we were number one in entertainment on the ship for 11 months that year, and that we didn't work the 12th month. So, mm-hmm. you know, and for something like that to happen and they just throw us away, it just made me realize, like, at the end of the day, we're all just a number on a sheet of paper.
That's right.
And so coming to events like this where I can be surrounded by peers and the work you put in is genuinely appreciated. That's mm-hmm. great. I don't have the desire, like, you know, we kind of talked about ships and stuff. I don't have a desire to be somebody's number on a spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, which is all you are, I guess, you know, basically then too.
Yeah. So I've started doing a lot more fundraiser shows or things of that nature. And actually kind of going back to the mentorship thing, there's a local group of magicians. I wanted the Spokane Magic Club, the IBM ring there, to do a club show.
Sure.
And I got like zero response.
Really?
And I was so frustrated.
The club didn't want to participate?
They're just dragging their feet. And there was a handful of people that responded directly, but the club in general was like, no. And I've been asking them for a long time, right? So six of us kind of broke away and I was like, okay, I'll produce the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
You guys all help promote, you show up, we'll split the money evenly. And man, we've been having a blast with it. The show's called Confusium. It's a prolific performance of prestidigitators and perfectors of the profound.
Okay.
And it's half mentalism. And then it's just a bunch of club guys and we're putting theatrical lighting, which you'll see, we brought our own lighting for the show here tonight. And so we program lights for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Spokane show we did, they did all the marketing. We did the theatrics of the lights and we bring in our own sound. And it just has been really cool. And the whole point of it was, I didn't realize until later of kind of the role of being a mentor in this, because half of the magicians are younger than me and they'd like watched me when they were kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really fun to get to kind of share the stage with people that are hungry to learn. And I think what they've learned is they don't want to haul and set up as much crap as I have to bring. So they're going to stick to mentalism. But it's really neat to kind of show them the grounds of like how to do marketing, how to get press releases. Like, I mean, we get newspaper coverage anytime we ask. We get front page magazines sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of showing those ropes. And that was why I put together the Magic Master Summit years ago in 2016 and 17, I think. And it was just to help kind of educate. Not we can all buy a bunch of tricks, but like sure. There's so much more to it, and that was something that I really wanted to get out there, is just to be able to help people through all the people we've all grown up watching,
right?
Like help them understand how to take that show to another level. And I don't know, I'm big on this mentorship kick right now because I think it's undervalued and it's not promoted enough. To
have people sought you out, or do you seek out people who would be your Telemachus?
I have not sought it out. In fact, I would almost say that it's happened on accident and slightly begrudgingly.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never intended to be somebody's mentor. I've never viewed myself as like, hey, I've made it. I'm going to like
you go coach yourself somebody. Out. Okay.
No, but they say when the student's ready, the mentor appears.
Exactly.
And I think, or the coach appears, right? And I really believe that. And I've seen it in my own life in the magic world and in the bird training world. In the wingsuiting world, like there's the people show up at the right time in your life to help you through whatever phase it is. And when you recognize that and can embrace it,
mm-hmm.
I think that's where the magic can really happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I don't know how many shows we'll do with this group of magicians from Spokane. We might do a full tour. We might do two more. I don't know. But that's the beauty of it, is that as long as we're all learning something every time, and they're coming to me like, oh, we're hungry to know more. And I'm like, okay, well, Let's dive in. So, yeah, when the student's ready, the mentor appears.
It's interesting because Stan Allen and I have talked about this a lot, in which most of the magicians know enough tricks. It's a matter of how to do them entertainingly and more, you know, properly. Yeah. But you're taking it yet to another level that's beyond that of, like, particularly for illusions, of being able to repair them. Also the marketing, the business side of it, the accounting and everything else, you're going to tax, whatever you're going to have to do, particularly that if you have animals, again, taking care of that, that's a whole other thing. I had Nicholas St. Ernst on podcast one time, who is a veterinarian, and especially is like fish. I mean, tropical fish. I mean, who would operate on a goldfish? I mean, here's a quarter, get another one, you know. But yeah, anyhow, he is a magician then also, and has talked a lot about how that you're supposed to care for your rabbits and doves and whatnot.
Yeah.
And it is very important. I don't think people sometimes appreciate all that. I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but I'm just saying there's so much more than necessarily, of course, we learn the tricks, and that's where a lot of magicians stop, and they don't go to the next level, which is why I think perhaps you might have had the problem of when you were trying to say, hey, let's do a fundraiser and get some money for the treasury or whatever. And they're yeah. saying, no, you know, they don't, number one, know how.
Yeah.
And then number two is kind of like, I don't want to venture out and try something new. I just want to do this trick for my friends. You
yeah.
know,
we just cashed an $11,000 check for That's doing great. A community show yeah. and all the people putting the show together benefited, right? Like mm-hmm. it's a win-win-win. The community wins, like, and we put together programs where everybody has a QR code in it, and they're really nice programs. 8.5 by 11, glossy, like really nice. Mm-hmm. My friend Ryan C. Reed did all the design work on it. And we can use that template for all these other future shows, but it's an ad piece, right? Mm-hmm. And we're out there showcasing in our local hometowns where people can buy our services. I think something interesting is, in the bird training world, I focus on building confidence and the skills will follow. And what I mean by that is, if I'm trying to get a parrot to fly from a perch to 6 feet, mm-hmm. and that's really all it's capable of, and I get to 6 feet and then I try to get it to fly to 7 feet, and maybe it doesn't quite get it at 7 feet, hmm. well, now it's not going to fly 6 feet because it broke confidence because we tried pushing the skills too fast.
Yeah, interesting.
And so, and yeah, I use that as an example because I have a lot of flight training students where I'm helping them get their birds to fly and then eventually outside. So, but that's a really common problem. And so, as I said, you know, when the student's ready, the mentor appears. Well, I've got a girl that I'm coaching to teach free flight for me, so eventually I don't have to do all that. And she calls me when we're on the drive, and she's like, hey, can you share the folder so I can look at the footage before the call in an hour and a half? And I'm like, oh crap, I'm mm-hmm. driving. I'm not going to make the call. I was like, do you want to take it? And she's only done like 15 minute blurbs in this, mm-hmm. in this stuff. And she's 17, she's almost 18. And she's like, I don't know. So she's super nervous. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, I'm going to build confidence. The skills will follow. She knows all the information, but I want to build her confidence so that she knows the information.
Sure.
And the skill of the presentation will follow. So where am I going with all this? With the mentorship that happened with the show Confusium, the cool thing about it is that I'm not having them need to focus on an hour of skills. They only have to focus on a 10-minute segment or 15-minute segment, and that's going to develop the confidence. Mm-hmm. And so, like, when I was doing cruise ships, I'd always put the new material in the Welcome Aboard show so I could build confidence and, you know, so to speak, the skills would follow. And so I think all of this coming full circle to say, from the mentorship angle, the advantage of this particular show is that they have those small bits that they can do, but also looking at the conventions and having these contests. I'm sad I don't get to see more stage magic competitions. Hmm. And I was sitting next to, actually, one of our bird training clients came out from Michigan to watch the show tonight. Hmm. And so, and we've been hanging out the whole week watching the shows. And he's like, so this is how you started, was with competitions? And I'm like, yeah. And it was done a little bit differently back then, where we had to make sure, like, it was a show. Mm-hmm. And there was an MC, and we better have our stuff ready. And we really learned a lot of that, but we only had to focus on little 8-minute bites at a time, mm-hmm. and build those skills. And the more we did that, the more confident we came, and we were able to build a bigger show.
Kind of like a comedy club, I guess, where they just, you know, go out for a first night, you do a little bit, and then a little bit more, and you kind of
yeah.
work on those moments, those minutes, and what laughs, what works, what doesn't,
exactly.
and actually build an act that way.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I think the magic competitions are you know, great deadlines for people to get their acts together.
You've won a lot of awards. You won a junior award when you were back, what, 2003 or something?
The big one was PCAM. I was 17.
2007?
What would that ish. Have been? Early, like probably 2001?
Okay-ish.
Yeah, I think. My math's not that great. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have to be to do illusions. But yeah, I think it was around 2001. I got the gold medal for PCAM. And that was really cool. I was doing 17 shows a week at a theme park that year, mm-hmm. so I was able to be bad someplace first,
right.
and really hone that act. And I had a full show that I was doing, but the focus was the bird act, and that's what really started it for me. And Yeah, I remember Rick Thomas had in his show, he said, had a bit about his mom saying, you can't get rid of the doves or the rings.
Correct. He still says that.
Yeah. So I've kind of, you know, my mom never told me what to do that I listened to, but I was that kid. But yeah, I just like having the doves in the show. And I think for me, we've done so many shows. I'm so grateful for that. But in the shows, when we do these runs that are, you know, 12 shows a week for years on end, there gets to be a monotony to it. And it loses, you lose your edge a little bit because it becomes so cookie cutter that throwing an animal in there keeps it fresh every show.
Oh, it does, because you don't know how that animal's going to react.
Yep. They say don't work with animals or kids. And now my 11-year-old daughter's in the show, and so are the birds, and so are the parrots, and so is my wife. And we have a blast, and it keeps all of us on our toes. And
every show.
Yeah, every show.
Where do you think people can work now if they want to start doing, number one, I guess, as you suggest, you encourage people to enter contests and start getting some experience, because first of all, you have a deadline to work towards. And then also you are working on trying to have something that's going to be tight and taking things out and have a director and all that kind of a thing. But beyond that, where do you think people can find, I mean, you mentioned theme parks in larger cities or some place that are destinations, there might be some theme parks, but it's kind of, I would think, hard to get in some of those then too. But
yeah,
what do you think, like doing something for your Rotary Club or Lions Club?
I'll say what worked for me. And that was in high school, I rented the local theater every year.
Oh, you put on your own shows.
And I put on my own shows.
That's interesting.
And if I was giving that same advice to somebody now that doesn't have a full show, I'd say do it anyway and get three or four of your buddies and each do 20, 25 minutes, you have a full show. And eventually somebody might not be able to make the show and you've got to come up with a little extra material and everybody comes up with a little extra material. So you try your B stuff. And it turns out your B stuff has some A moments and then those turn into actual A routines and and you can grow your show that way. I'm an entrepreneur. I would say most magicians fall under that category as well. But I think oftentimes we're limited by thinking we have to follow, you know what, there's ABC, NBC, and CBS. If I could just land a TV special on one of those, I could tour like Copperfield. Well, that method doesn't work anymore.
No.
But what will always work is a little bit of hard work and be willing to rent the theater, be willing to, when I approached all the guys from the Spokane Magic Club, I said, look, the buy-in is $500. I didn't say, look, we're all going to make money. I said, we're buying into the show for $500. That covers all our expenses. If we don't sell a single ticket, guess what? We at least have demo footage. Cool. I'd pay $500 for demo footage.
Good demo, sure.
And people just, I think, need to run the numbers on that and just be okay. Like, worst case, what am I out? $2,000 is probably more common for smaller theaters, unless you split it with a few people. But yeah, do that. Or like I worked restaurants when I was 15, 16, 17, and 18. At first, because I was too young to be paid. So I was 15. I did it for gift cards and I would sell the gift cards. I think people need to not be afraid to work. And
good point.
And I believe I hope the younger generation hears this. And by younger, I say, you know, kind of 30 and under, maybe even 20 and under, but I'll sum it up as 30 and under. I see in general, a lack of discipline and a lack of willingness to work hard. Or excuses for, oh, I can't make the show today, I'm sick. I've literally been in the hospital bed with an IV hooked up, and I'm in costume because I have to be on the floor in 10 minutes.
Oh, my.
Across town. Well, this was in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Yeah.
I had to go down the hill and then up the next hill to get back into the arena. So I unplugged from the IV. So I was sick with the flu.
Wow.
And I did the show, and I went right back up, plugged back in after the show. And, you know, there's no being sick. And I really wish that work ethic was... It was in our, my generation, I would assume your generation, it was like, yeah, I will be there. I said, I'll be there.
Right.
And I would encourage young magicians right now to honor that integrity and push through any illness and go out there and well, I can't say that legally, any illness, but you guys with reason, sure. Like, don't be dumb, but like push through and go. I've done shows with a broken skull. I broke it in Roatan on my birthday. It was May 4th and then May 5th at a show. And it was like, I still did the show.
Right. Well, I'm so glad to hear you at your age, here in the early 40s, of espousing those beliefs and telling the younger generation, because I feel like as an older guy, I feel the same way. It's like I'm in my brain as you're saying that, yes, I applaud every word that you're saying right there, but I'm thinking, okay, that's the old guy in me. It's like, well, why we used to be, you know.
Here's the reality for whoever wants to take this or leave it. Like, if you want to work, that's what it takes. And if you're willing to do that, you will be... sitting here in 20 years doing the closing show of the next big thing. Do it, you know, like you got to pay your dues. And if you're not willing to do it, get out now before you waste hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, having fun. But it's hard work, man.
Well, that is the thing about illusions. And we'll start to wrap up then here. And that is the cost that's involved with that. Whereas the cost of entry as a magician typically is a deck of playing cards.
Yeah.
And that's how a lot of people get started. That's great. I mean, you were just talking about working restaurants. You're doing close-up things then as well, which transitions and those kinds of skills are important to use in stage illusions because there are a lot of things you do as far as understanding principles and everything that you learn from close-up. But my point is a lot of times with illusions that we're going to be costing tens of thousands of dollars possibly, and then, you know, having dancers and choreography and music and oh my gosh, you know, lights and sound and everything else that's around there for 5 minutes of that, it's like, okay, let's bring out the next box, you know, or whatever kind of a thing. But the thing is to try to make that entertaining and something that's memorable. I personally love Rick Thomas's Girl Without a Middle routine with the Invisible Man that he does, in which he has video of the old Claude Rains black and white movie playing in the background, and he has his head wrapped and on a mask and he does this thing and but has dancers and everything, but the point is that it has a reason where he's turning invisible. There's like something that he makes, I don't know, a 5 minute or 3 minute trick into about 8 to 10 minutes that is really entertaining in my opinion. I know some people don't care for that particular routine, but that's one of my favorites that he does. Anyhow, I'm just saying, as an illusionist, get ready to buckle up and write some checks.
Yeah, but
but you're going to get your money back too.
You build it one piece at a time, you know.
Good and point.
My friend Tony, he runs a donut shop actually. So as a fellow business guy, he was like, this stuff's not cheap, is it? And I started around the math. I'm like, for my 30 minute set here, I've got over $55,000 in props. Mm-hmm. Like, and I don't say that to be like, oh, I've got 55. Yeah. Like, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that. Like, I wish I was as good with a deck of cards as I am with the stage environment. But the stage environment is what I always want to do. And I would like to believe I excel in it. I at least do more than close up.
Yeah.
And that's the path. And that, there's going to be some expense, but it all works out. You know, it's just, if you've got that passion and that drive, you'll find ways to make it work.
That's a very good advice. Yeah, right there. You'll find ways to make that work. So then you get your money back then. But the hard thing is trying to find the venues where you can go perhaps and perform those kinds of things. And then, as you say, being a road warrior and having to travel across the country to go and do some of these shows as it starts to evolve.
With us traveling.
Just get used to that.
Yeah, my family and I drove, like I said, 4 days. And then I flew my stage manager out from Boise and he had a hell of a drive or a trip too. He was stuck in Boise with all the, you know, a lot of the airline issues right now. And then he was stuck in Atlanta, and Sperry was stuck in Atlanta, but he got an hour earlier flight than my buddy. And so, even the stage manager who flies out is having a hard time, you know, we're all paying our dues and I think the only reason you do it is because you love it. You know, it's not a business that I think anybody should get into thinking we'll get rich doing it.
Right.
You might.
Well,
probably won't is my advice, unless you find a way to do it. Like, there's ways to do it, but.
Yeah. But do it because you love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which leads me to the final question. My podcast is called The Magic Word. So I always close by asking my guests what it is that's important to them. What is advice or that you live by when you wake up in the morning? It could be a word or a phrase.
Well, I'll give you two. A phrase that I live by, which is terrible for skydivers, but is hurry up and fail.
Yeah. First, don't succeed. Then try skydiving.
Yeah. You really leave an impact. Oof. Boom. But no. Hurry up and fail. And by that, I mean, don't be afraid to make a mistake because it's going to happen. So just hurry up, get it done, learn from it. Cool. Fix it, move on.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. Right. And if you can compartmentalize what that looks like for example, in a skydive, there's going to be a jump where my parachute doesn't open properly. Mm-hmm. It happened on a balloon jump that my mom was on, actually. It didn't open right. I couldn't get out of it. So I cut away and I fly my reserve down. So it's like, cool. Now that I've done that, I'm not worried about flying my reserve. I would prefer not to.
Sure.
But hurry up and fail. Like, now that I've done it, cool. I have the confidence that it does what it's supposed to, that I made the right choices when I needed to. And I think it's the same with, you know, whether you're renting a theater or you're trying to get your close-up gig at a restaurant and you're working for tips, as long as you pass out a business card to every single person, cool. You know what? You're going to make some mistakes. And as you kind of brought up, like, you learn so much from doing close-up that you can apply to the stage. Mm-hmm. Just the psychology of how people think mm-hmm. was some of the best training. And I hated it. I dreaded Friday and Saturday nights. But I did it until I built up a big enough show that I didn't need to do it. And I'm grateful that I did close-up. And I think the one word answer, because it was, I felt like I maybe got asked two versions of the question, which I appreciate because I can talk a little more, would be faith. And whether that is faith in the higher power, faith in your abilities, but just have faith that if you're putting in the work, the right opportunities will come your way.
Love it. Love it. That's very important. Good words of advice to live by. Thanks very much, David. I appreciate it. It's been
Thank
a
you.
Nice chat with you for this past hour. Boy, it flew by.
It's been a pleasure. Hopefully people really got value out of this.
Good stuff. Thanks very much. And so were the Magic Word Podcast. That was David DaVinci. This is Scotty out. Thank you very much, David, for being my guest here this week. It was just a great conversation. And as I just mentioned, I can't believe how quickly that this hour has gone because, golly, we just went into so many different things and you have a fascinating life. And thank you for sharing that with us. And I know you, the listeners, got a lot out of that. And perhaps you might be able to put some of that to use in your own life as well, particularly his words of recommendation there at the end. If you have an opportunity to see David DaVinci performing somewhere, and it's anywhere within driving distance, I highly recommend that you go to see him, or if he is ever on the bill at a magic convention, be sure to catch him. I'm sure you will be thrilled also, just because he is that thrill illusionist. And if you get a chance to chat with him, please tell him that you enjoyed hearing him on this conversation on the Magic Word Podcast. If you would like to see the kind of act that he does, there are a couple of videos on the magicwordpodcast.com website here this week. One was his show in its entirety, as was filmed, I believe, back in 2013 at the IBM convention in Phoenix when he closed the show, one of the evening shows out there. So you might want to see him perform there. It's really good. Well, until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to have faith. This is Scotty out.